It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Of shores and savannas, evolutionary aspects of animal-sourced food nutrition. Well, I want to welcome Laura Iannotti, and Laura, you are from Washington University in St. Louis. You're going to have to explain the title. I mean, when you end up talking about animal-sourced nutrition and from, you know, savannas forward, what does that mean?
Essentially, what we're trying to argue is that in our hominid history, we subsisted on a diet that looks very different than today. So for approximately 99.5% of hominid time...
Explain that word, hominid.
Hominid is all of our ancestors. So Homo erectus, Homo naledi, Homo... different hominids in our lineage, I would say.
Halfway along that line was Homo sapiens somewhere?
200,000 years ago is when Homo sapiens emerged.
How many Homo somethings were there before the Homo sapiens?
Well, let me first say as well that I am not an anthropologist nor an archaeologist.
Okay.
So I couldn't give you an exact number, and frankly, they're still discovering these. Yeah. But what's interesting to me is to look at that evolutionary time scale and the period of time that we were consuming a diet that looks different from today. And a large part of that diet, you know, others have proposed what's called the shore-based paradigm, was comprised of seafood or foods that we accessed close to water. Things like seaweed or eggs from shorebirds, mollusks or crustaceans, and fish. So our diets were, largely comprised of that. It wasn't until very recently, like 0.01% of that time, that in the Industrial Revolution occurred and that we had the introduction of processed foods. 10,000 years ago, that's only 0.53% of that hominid time. Was when crop foods were introduced. And again, not part of that long evolutionary history.
So up until 10,000 years ago, So it was all hunter-gatherers and fishermen and people that were eating animals that they could catch or shoot, and well, they weren't shooting or spearing or something. And the same thing with the fish or gathering berries and things that grew wild. That was a diet.
That's exactly right. And what I've described in my presentation is that we think that's related to some of those anatomical differences that we see at those different junctures in the past. So when Homo erectus, which is one of our ancestors, emerged, we saw differences in brain size. So there was an increase by threefold in what's called the encephalization quotient, which is the brain mass to body mass.
Which period was this again?
This was approximately 2 million years ago.
Uh-huh.
So the Homo erectus compared to other primates or other hominids like Australopithecus, for example. Mm-hmm. So these anatomical differences, brain size, we were taller, we had smaller intestine, we think is because of the introduction of animal source foods in the diet.
But then when we developed agriculture, how did we change after we had agriculture and we were learning how to produce all these grains?
So that's the interesting part of the story, I think, that people often don't know about. So approximately 10,000 years ago, with the advent of agriculture, we started staying still. So we were no longer in those hunter-gatherer groups, but we were more sedentary. Mm-hmm. We were growing crops. We were living closer together. So we saw an increase in infectious diseases, and we saw a deterioration of our diet quality. And as a result, there were changes in our health. So we did become sicker. Our lifespan was cut in half. So we went from living till 40 years down to 20 years. We actually got shorter. And brain size got a little bit smaller.
Wait a minute. This is just incredible.
Yeah.
Nobody would think this. if you weren't going back and looking, you go back a couple million years and then back into this period, because it's counterintuitive. It seems like we think of progress. So progress would mean that you learn how to cultivate and you've learned how to grow maize or corn and rice and wheat and all these things that as a result that the human body, including the brain, would be improving too. And the evidence is that that's not the case.
Well, perhaps in evolution, you know, and from the point of view of survival, we were able to produce more offspring with the advent of it. We could feed more people. We just weren't feeding them as well. And so what you see is also the emergence of a lot of nutritional problems globally. We have deficiencies in certain minerals like iron and zinc, which are found bioavailable in animal source foods. And with the disappearance of some of those foods on a daily basis or weekly basis, we're not really sure, those deficiencies emerge, and those are resulting in some of these health consequences.
This must be something that's when this comes up at a party that you're at, or you know, coffee with your friends, or jogging together, or whatever you do. I imagine you run into some skeptics, because this is just such a different vision than what we think of. But I also wonder if some people are saying that some of that story helps them legitimize their embracing a paleo diet. Is that right?
Well, I think number one, what I'm referring to is not the fad paleo diet. It is, in fact, paleolithic nutrition. That's correct to label it that, but it is not the paleo diet, which does look different than paleolithic nutrition.
In what way?
I think in the way that, you know, people assume that this is a license to eat a lot of meat every day. That wouldn't necessarily have been the case. A big hunt would have occurred maybe every so often, and a lot of those nutrients are actually stored. So eating it periodically was important, but not necessarily as frequently as the paleo diet would require. I think the other very important difference is with paleolithic nutrition or evolutionary nutrition, we saw a lot more dietary diversity. So hunter-gatherer groups, these hominids were moving around and consuming very different foods, a great variety of foods. So it's not only that there was more animal source food, it's also that there was more variety. Mm-hmm. So there's a different sort of composition of the diet during that period. We did see higher protein intakes. We had higher fat intakes, but it was different kinds of fats. So we had more of the long-chain fatty acids that you would find in fish, for example. The N3 fatty acids were higher in our diet than present day. We had, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, but if you're talking about the diets that are taking place kind of around the world, because whatever people were called at that time, they were in Asia, they were in Africa, they were in Europe, and they must have been adapting and eating what was available there.
That's absolutely right.
So did that change their health too, because that they were so kind of in tune with where they lived and what were the right berries and nuts and animals and fish that were in their particular region?
I think you're absolutely right. And maybe part of our problem today is that we're somewhat disconnected from those environments and from our biomes that we exist in. Perhaps that's part of the problem today. But you're absolutely right. There's documentation that there was a lot of adaptation to different environments and to different contexts as people moved around, as the dispersal.
So it's kind of like cavemen Torah.
Right.
they were eating with a sense of place.
They were. You're so correct in that. Yes.
No, that's really, really fascinating. So if we could pull somebody out 10,000 years ago and stick somebody in Asia and stick them in Africa, they might not have done very well, because it's not what their system was used to.
Right.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
How much of those traits are able to stay with us, to become part of our DNA as we've continued to evolve, that do those origins in us still speak to us from 10,000 years ago?
I think that's a fundamental question that I have not been able to answer from the literature. So I have looked into, you know, sort of the time frame it takes for genetic traits or for the genome to be altered. The best that we have been able to do is something I referred to in the presentation, which is the emergence of lactase persistence, which is an enzyme that allows us to be lactose tolerant post-weaning period. And this emerged in dairying populations, so people who were more reliant on milk were able to consume it well past the weaning period. And that was a shorter period, only about 2,000 years. If you look at that in the scheme of our evolutionary history, that's not very long.
Now, I've heard it said that Asian populations have a higher percentage of lactose intolerance than, say, Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Why would that be?
Again, maybe going back to a lower dependency on drinking milk. You know, maybe there are certain things in their genome that it was better adapted to. There's higher consumption of seafood in a lot of Asian countries, for example. I don't know.
Well, I know. It's really
interesting.
It's curious. So as we've kept evolving, and now agriculture today, we have agriculture all over the world. So we are producing all of these row crops and grains and so forth. But we also have everything else available to us, too. There's choices in meat consumption, for example, and animal-source food consumption. But there's a lot of criticism on that. And on the one hand, we're hearing people say, we're possibly eating too much meat and look at sustainability. And the other hand, people look at countries that are getting on their feet and they're improving their diet. One of the first things they want to do is eat more meat. Mm-hmm. Are there any lessons, do you think, in this evolutionary history that helps us look at what we're going through currently, and we should kind of learn from what we've gone through in the past?
I think it's the right question to ask, is what is the frequency and quantity of animal source food consumption that we need to thrive? I don't think anybody's answered that question. But you're absolutely right that there are great disparities in consumption of animal source foods. And that's the topic of several presentations, I think, at this conference. That in some places consuming too much and in other places not enough.
So we started with a period of time that people were relatively healthy, all the other things you could die from, so they only lived to 40. But then they started dying at 20, at the average age, and you go through what would have been hundreds of years or 1,000 years or something, in that valley.
Right.
So the life expectancy went down, they became shorter, they kind of had smaller brains.
Right.
All these things seem like bad things. When did it swing back up again? What was going on when we started seeing that people were, in fact, starting to get taller? Brains were starting to get larger, life expectancy was growing. What happened then?
I think some of the sort of public health innovations that occurred in the early part of last century, I would say, would be responsible for some of those improvements. So cleaning up communities, just sanitation, hygiene, sanitation sort of interventions that reduced infectious diseases. Vaccines are another reason why I think we're living much longer. But then you do have improved dietary quality. Japan has the longest lifespan, Japanese women, in fact. If we look at their diets, we see a whole lot more seafood, for example, in the diets, and less processed foods. And so hopefully we can move in that direction, healthier, longer lives.
But if you go back 10,000 years, and there really weren't processed foods. We're talking about fundamental differences between fruits, nuts, meats, and produce and vegetables, fruits and vegetables. But what we consider processed foods or heavily processed foods, it's relatively new, isn't it?
It's brand new. So again, in the scheme of our evolutionary time frame, it's only 0.01% of that time period. So, you know, since the Industrial Revolution and the production of ultra-processed foods, that's only about 100 years ago that we've been consuming.
So we don't know for sure how this is going to look in the long scheme of things.
We certainly don't.
But there's a lot of people guessing that it's not going to be good.
Well, we're already seeing, you know, diabetes exploding in many places. We're already seeing, you know, chronic diseases on the increase.
Well, you get both ends of the spectrum, undernutrition, undernourished and overnourished.
Correct. And in the middle is poor diet quality. And that's one thing that we're trying to, you know, we can find a middle ground that's going to improve for both ends of the spectrum.
There's already been some talk about life expectancies starting to shorten. Are we also seeing people literally getting shorter? And are we starting to see any evidence of brain size decreasing?
I don't think there's any documented systematic evidence of that. I think what I referred to in my presentation is just archaeological evidence, you know, showing a difference between early human Homo sapien Cro-Magnon in Europe consuming seafood to more modern Homo sapiens consuming less of the seafoods and animal source foods.
Yeah.
So nothing that's well-documented evidence-based there.
So as a scientist that's been looking at this area, looking at history and looking at the effects of history and all these stages that we've gone through up today, what are you most curious about now? Because I'm sure it just seems to me like scientists that are in it, pursuing their passion, the element that they have oftentimes is curiosity. They really want, you know, I'm really wondering about this, and they would like to see their own research kind of answer a question. Do you have some of that that is driving you that you're curious about?
Yes, I mean, I think I'm not naive enough to believe that we can all go back to hunter-gatherer existence, but I guess the question that, you know, that I have is, can we come up with diets that are context specific, that are respectful to the environment, but also drawing more from that evolutionary past? That's the question that I have.
And do you have a theory? I mean, if we could, what that might look like?
We're actually going to test this in Ecuador. We're going to derive a diet that's based on what's available, you know, in that context and acceptable, and we're going to test and see whether or not there are positive effects on brain development. And
you know, this is so fascinating, and you're Dr. Laura Iannotti, and so there was a time where you were a little girl and you weren't a doctor. I mean, when did it occur to you that someday I'm going to grow up and be a professor, be a scientist at the Washington University in St. Louis? I mean, how'd you get to this?
You know, my parents are both scientists. My dad actually was in agriculture engineering, and my mother was a teacher, science teacher. And I decided I wanted to rebel and not do that for a period of time. So I did liberal arts, and I did political science and foreign affairs, and which was a good thing. It taught me how to write. But in many ways, you can't deny your past, to go back to the theme. It's part of who you are, I think. So it took me about 10 years of working. I was working in nutrition for the UN, for different NGOs, and coming at it from a food security point of view. And it wasn't until I did my PhD in public health at Hopkins that I sort of fell in love with academia and teaching and research. And now it's the best job in the world.
It's the best job in the world. It's just so interesting, the things that you've gotten into. So how long have you been in St. Louis now?
Approximately 10 years.
Okay. Yeah. And then you're... Fortunately, I'm having an opportunity to speak to you because you've been able to come to UC Davis to speak at a conference, and I would imagine you get to attend some conferences around the world. And how often you get to some of these events and a light goes off and saying, boy, I hadn't thought of that. This gets you thinking in a different way.
Mm-hmm. I think it happens most often when I'm talking to people who are coming from very different perspectives. discipline. So on my team, I generally have people that are far-ranging, you know, from engineering or from radiology or from anthropology. And it's when you interact, I think, with people with those different methods and different techniques that you get inspired by different innovative thinking.
And your team, you have other people. Is it a laboratory that you are organizing or a department? How?
It's a lab. So we're called the E3 Nutrition Lab. And the three E's stand for evolutionarily appropriate, environmentally sustainable, and economically affordable. And it's comprised of students, graduate students, but also, as I mentioned, some of these experts from different disciplines.
And in that case, when you start looking at the 3 points that you were talking about, the three E's, the evolution we've talked quite a bit about, but then we try to get into sustainability now. Mm-hmm. One of the other things that seems to be very different from history, so many more people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about a time back when all these changes when agriculture was formed. I don't know, were there a couple million people or something in the whole world? And now we're talking about 10 billion people in the not-too-distant future. Mm-hmm. That's got to be a big change in the whole dynamic of how things work out.
It is. It is somewhat daunting to think about feeding that many people. But in our research, we are trying to come up with these solutions that were part of the evolutionary diet, but that are environmentally appropriate. So an example is from Kenya. We're working on the coast with a fisheries ecologist at University of Rhode Island to think about seafoods that, when extracted from that environment, aren't going to be harmful to that ecosystem. So it might be seaweeds or it might be a certain kind of fish that we would encourage people to consume that's respecting that ecosystem. I think we really have to move away from the Anthropocene perspective, think more about the concept of one health, in which we're considering the health of plants, animals, and humans. So it's very much a principle that we try to uphold in our research.
Anthropocene,
right. So that humans at the top we should be in what's called the Holocene. Uh-huh. But now it's being...
These new words for me, too. I love them. It's terrible. What have I left out?
I don't know. Those are fantastic questions. I don't know. You're very bright because you quickly pick up on subject matter, I can see.
Well, you know, I'm just really curious.
Really bright,
I like listening. And so I gave up on ever writing questions down. I think it's a lot better to be curious. As we wrap up, two questions. Number one, if people want to see more about your work or what's being done at Washington University, your particular research, what your group's working on, where could they find that information?
They can go to our website, which is, again, the E3 Nutrition Lab. If you just Google that, you'll find it at Washington University in St. Louis. You can also look at the Brown School at Washington University in St. Louis, where we have an MPH program, MSW program, MSP program.
So there may be some little girls and little boys that are listening. I don't know how young our crowd is right now, and they'd like to grow up, go to university and study something like that. Any words of encouragement for people that say, gee, I'm not sure what I want to do when I grow up, but I'm really curious about some of these things. What do you advise people? Maybe there's kids right now that are coming out of high school, going into a college somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
How do you would encourage them to pursue?
I would definitely encourage them to think about the discipline of public health. And the reason is that public health allows you to think across different dimensions, from cells to society and across different disciplines. It's one of the most fun career areas, I would say expertise areas, because when you're thinking about population health, you have to think about societal determinants down to biological determinants. So what I would encourage people to think about, not just pre-med, but public health.
Should be paying attention to that. We may be starting a whole new era that we're going through, and because of our diets, everybody's going to get short and die younger, or maybe the other way around.
Right.
Hopefully the other way around.
Right.
And then the final question I have for you, though, is we have this conversation 5 years from now, and you look back on the 5 years that just passed, What would you like to have seen happen in the area that you function in?
I would like to see the world pay attention to disparities in terms of income, but also in terms of nutrition disparities. I would hope as well, and I actually have a lot of hope in the younger generation who are paying attention to the environment. I think they have the capability to save the planet and keep people healthy. Sure of that.
Well, those are words of encouragement. And Laura Iannotti, I really appreciate your being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us loud, Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.